Welcome to Chat Cyber, a podcast on all things cyber policy, where we explore key issues and discuss policy strategies with industry experts.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Chat Cyber, Cyber Florida's policy podcast. As always, I'm your host, James Jacobs, Cyber Florida's Associate Director for Partnerships and Policy.
And I am your co-host, Jordan Deulis, Cyber Policy Analyst at Cyber Florida.
We want to thank you guys for tuning back into another episode. We're joined today by Jack Clabby. Jordan, can you share a little bit of Jack's bio with us?
Absolutely. Jack is an attorney at Carlton Fields, one of the oldest and largest law firms in Florida. He moved to Tampa 10 years ago from New Jersey, where he was a federal cyber prosecutor. In his law practice, Jack now advises companies, schools, nonprofits, and government entities on legal issues related to cybersecurity, privacy, and data protection. He frequently acts as a first chair breach coach, guiding clients through cybersecurity incidents. Jack also represents those companies in court when they're sued after cybersecurity events or if a consumer takes issue with their privacy practices. Listeners may, of course, know him as the host of the No Password Required podcast produced by Cyber Florida. Jack, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's awesome to be here. I've been following the pod, and it's great to see you and James outside of the Sunshine CyberCon, which is where I typically run into you all. So really glad to be on the podcast and share what I can about what's been happening in Florida on the policy side.
Jack, we're just straight up starstruck. We were joking before we hit record. Like, Jack's such a big deal, man. He's so good at this. They're going to fire us from our podcast and hire Jack.
James, I want to make it clear too that I am wearing a tie. So if you're just listening to this, I want everyone to know that there's a little extra. I did get a little jazzed up just to honor being here on season one of the podcast.
That is awesome. Since they let me out of the Capitol and the general let me come to work over here, I don't think I've put on a tie since. So.
It was a promise you made to yourself, and you're going to keep it. I like that.
Jack, we usually start these out with a segment called Explain It to James. Also, as we were joking before we hit record, talking about some of our families and loved ones and how deep they could go into cybersecurity policy. It's also always an extreme joke that I now work at Cyber Florida because I'm the least tech-savvy millennial you'll ever meet in your life. But I know policy, so they let me in the front door. So a lot of the concepts we talk about on this podcast, they're deep and they're not easily understood by the layperson that might be tuning in. So could you tell us specifically, what does a cyber lawyer do? What does your day look like?
Sure. So we sometimes talk about the three intervention points for a cybersecurity attorney, right? The first is before a security incident happens, then it's during a security incident, and then it's after a security incident. So if you think of it as like a firefighter, right? You know, fire prevention is the first step. We're going to come in, we're going to look, and we're going to see, do you have any place where you have dry wood right next to gasoline and matches? Right. Then you have during the incident, which is like responding to the fire. And then after the incident, sort of like an arson investigator trying to figure out what caused this fire. What do we have to do? Who do we have to talk to about what happened here on the fire scene? So those are sort of the three areas where we get involved. What we're not, right? So as a cybersecurity attorney, my expertise is in the law around cybersecurity. I am not a forensic investigator. I'm better than most. Like, I'm better than the average person you can pull in off a street, but that's not where my skills and my credentials are. I'm very good at helping a company hire a cybersecurity forensic investigator after an incident and working to translate what the forensic investigator might be saying so that the company can make decisions in a legal framework after that. So that's really what I do most of the day. Is I'm talking to companies before a security event, during a security event, during the crisis, and then in the aftermath. And I think most of the time, my main value add is that I'm a translator between business decision makers at a company or a nonprofit or a school and the cybersecurity folks who are either advising them on security practices or telling them where the bad guy is on the system and what they need to do for it.
So Jack, this is kind of a two-part question. In your experience, what are some of the most common cyber attacks that you're seeing? And what do you believe are the most difficult types to recover from, specifically relating to cost incurred and legal liability?
Yeah, so there's sort of the two big ones today are ransomware and business email compromise. And that's been the case for the last 5 years, but ransomware in particular, you know, it's not just bad guys putting something on the system that freezes up and bricks all the devices and the servers. They do that, plus they've taken the data and they're extorting, not just to unlock it, but they're extorting the company on penalty of releasing it on their public leak site, right? So it's the double extortion ransomware is still very popular, very hard to combat, and can throw a company into crisis. The business email compromise, you know, they can all sort of start the same way with a phishing email, but the business email compromise is not overt, right? The bad guy will get into the business email and start poking around, looking for information on wires, changing information on invoices that are due and payable, and trying to divert money. And they're trying to get away with it for as long as they can. So instead of coming in like a ransomware actor, surveilling, watching, and then freezing everything and extorting, the business email compromise will be a long-term play where they're trying to gather intelligence and directly steal money that's intended for the company. And it can sometimes last for a long time, even when it's begun the siphoning and the diversion. Now, the piece that adds to the cost, right? So there's the cost of the response, which is what does it pay to pay your vendors who are going to be helping a company deal with a security event? But then there's also the sort of long-term reputation cost and cost from going out. You know, the former, I think what surprises a lot of people is the biggest driver of cost is having to review the data that might have been exposed to the bad guy in order to give the notice that's required under various states' statutory frameworks. So in Florida, you know, the general rule is if personal information is at issue in a security event, a company needs to do a reasonable search for it and provide notification within a reasonable amount of time, you know, no later than 30 days. 30 days is sort of the outside piece of it. Now, there's some debate about when it starts, but the costs of reviewing an email account that has, you know, 5 or 6 years worth of email in it to determine if it has personal information is astronomical. And a lot of companies, even sophisticated ones, are shocked when we start to get quotes for what it is for a document review vendor to look through it. Now, there are automated tools that can help with that, but you're really talking about, you know, mid to high five figures for a decent sized email account. Now, there's a lot of variety to that, but I think that when notification laws were originally passed, I don't think legislatures understood that it was going to be imposing these sorts of costs on companies who are responding to these events. And I know that there are companies out there, certainly not companies we work with, but companies that I have encountered that simply look at the cost associated with an email account review or a server review for compromised data, and they just say, we're not going to do it. We're not going to pay $140,000 to look through all these servers to make statutory notice. It's simply too expensive. We'll take our chances and we'll just bury this. And so I think that's an area where the cost of this event doesn't always match up with what the policy sort of, you know, the policy choices of a legislature make. I don't know if there's a better solution, but the numbers are eye-popping, and many executives who, you know, start a conversation saying they want to do the right thing get really tested when they see that number.
Now, is there any risk to the organization to bury it? Are there any laws in Florida that is like, what's the consequence of doing that? Is there any law that gives a consequence?
Right. So it's true in Florida. It's true in almost every state, right? That if an organization in Florida that includes not just companies, but also, you know, government entities, if there is a security event that puts at issue personal information, you must do a search and you must give notice, right? So the law is fairly well established. Now, who enforces that law is subject to some debate, right? It's fairly clear. Or at least the state would argue that they can enforce it, right? So the Attorney General's office could bring an enforcement action, and that is one area of substantial risk. And consumers who find out about an event and either got notice but got notice late in their view, or got notice that was incomplete, or found out about an event potentially years later and never got notice, right? They can bring a private lawsuit. Now, they wouldn't bring a private lawsuit under the statute, right? So the statute in Florida does not directly allow a lawsuit. What they do is they bring a lawsuit alleging negligence, right? Negligence is a common law, they call it a cause of action, right? So you can you file a written complaint with the court. It says negligence, and it says, you know, Clabby Corp, you know, violated, you know, had a duty to provide me with notice, and they cite the statute as the source of the duty. And then they say under general common law principles, they failed to meet this duty in whatever way they did. And so that's how they try to bring a lawsuit.
Yeah. Just under negligence. So there's not a direct cause of action in Florida law for.
Correct. That's correct. And so that's been something that the legislature has played around with before, right? Mm-hmm. Do they want to provide a statutory cause of action for data security violation by a company of, and again, you need to think about what standard it would be that would trigger that. Other states that have done that, you know, have had a rush to a rush of lawsuits that have filed it. So I don't know if that's a decision that Tallahassee wants to make given its sort of open business environment at this stage. But having a cause of action. So let's say if a state passes a privacy law or a cybersecurity law that gives a private right of action, that really wouldn't change the landscape too much from what's there now. Because that's really what negligence, all those billboards you see, if you're driving down I-4, right, in Central Florida, or you go down the veterans outside Tampa, all those billboards are for lawyers who can sue under negligence. Now, there's specialized lawyers who sue for cybersecurity negligence. They have other sort of theories that they bring, but that's the world we live in today. The big change, right? So if Florida or any state were to say, not only is there a private right to sue, but you'll get something called statutory damages. That's the really big issue that everybody debates, right? And so some states, California is sort of the leading state on this, very different from Florida in terms of where its policies are. You know, California has a comprehensive privacy statute, and certain violations of that will give what they call statutory damages. So no matter what harm you actually as a consumer felt, you can sue and claim $300. So what that allows, right, is so right now, if someone were to sue under a negligence principle and say, I got a letter from Clabby Corp saying that my data was at issue in this breach event, they gave me 2 years of credit monitoring and insurance. I haven't actually experienced any identity theft. No one has charged something on my credit card. No one's tried to take out a loan in my name, but I'm really angry that this happened and I feel that my feelings are hurt. That lawsuit would get kicked out of court in Florida, okay? Because even if there were a violation, there's no damages. And the person doesn't have what's called in the law standing, right? They don't have an actual fight. Your feelings being hurt aren't enough to keep a lawsuit in court in 2024 in Florida.
So you say, at least in Florida.
In Florida. Now, if you brought that same lawsuit in California, it might be a little bit different, right? If you can, if in their document that starts the lawsuit, right, they can point to all the other factors under the statute, they can then point to statutory damages saying, I have $300 of damages under the statute that I'm entitled to, so I get standing. So the court might hear that, won't always. I mean, there's still constitutional concepts of standing you can use to defend that if you're the company, but it makes it a lot different. So that's a big area where if Florida is having a conversation about amending its cybersecurity rule or putting in place a comprehensive privacy statute, where you really want to pay attention, right? Is are we giving a private right to sue? And are we going to allow for consumers to have what's called statutory damages? Because that could really change it and make it a lot more expensive for companies to do business in the state of Florida.
Jack, a bit of a follow-up question for you. Let's call it a bonus, explain it to James. So this seems at face value an issue best left to be decided in D.C. If Florida, for example, were to pass a bill saying, you know, you now have this legal standing, create a cause of action based on privacy and cybersecurity, how would that be enforceable for multi-state, multinational corporations? Would somebody in California be able to walk into a Florida court and sue that corporation just in Florida? How does that work?
Yeah, so it comes up all the time, James. So in big breaches where large companies that had customers in all 50 states are have a massive event. Like, let's say you have a, you know, a 5 million consumer data breach in all 50 states, a number of plaintiffs, people who want to bring a lawsuit, will all sue that company. And they'll cite, each person will cite the state where they are a resident, that law, right? So there might be a California group of people who bring a lawsuit. There might be a group of New Jersey people who bring a lawsuit. There might be a group of Florida people who bring a lawsuit. And in many cases, those are moved from state court to federal court, and they're all consolidated. There's a big one going on in Boston right now. There's a big one going on in Minnesota right now. Sometimes these cases all get dumped before the same judge, all smushed together in one big multi-district litigation, or in front of one judge in a bunch of separate cases, or they stay in a whole bunch of different states and the defense counsel does their best to coordinate them. So it can get really ugly. There are those in the sort of legal community and in the business community, as well as in the plaintiff's bar, right? All sides of these things, who think that the solution is exactly what you're saying, is let's get a single standard, a federal standard, and have it be, you have it control what sort of security a company needs to have in a very general term, and then what remedy, if any, a consumer could have if their data is at issue. And there's a lot of debate about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And then the debate is also the same as the debate around car emissions, right? Would the federal standard be the floor and states would be allowed to have rules that are more restrictive on the companies? Or would you have the standard being set by the federal government and it preempting any state laws that might be more or less restrictive above it? So that's the other piece of what a federal standard would be. I think for the most part, most large businesses these days are advocating for a federal standard that is the standard, so that California can't come in and just, you know, make it more restrictive on top of that.
The cyber attacks that you see continuously, is there one sector that seems in your experience to be more prone to be attacked?
Yeah. So recently we've seen a lot of activity for software as a service companies. And so, you know, traditionally it's always healthcare and financial services, right? Banks and insurance companies and folks who have money and folks who have data. And also folks who, if you do things urgently. So if they're locked up by ransomware, they have to pay. All right. But more opportunistic bad guys have been going after scaled companies. So if you think about a software as a service company as a group of folks who invent a piece of software that then can be sold to 1,000 customers just as easily as 1,000,000, right? If you have an invention that's fully scalable, moving from 1,000 to 1,000,000 doesn't really require you to hire that many more employees. It's not like you're making cars where if I go from 1,000 to 1,000,000, I need to build new manufacturing plants. I need to get them out of there. I need to expand my IT and my security environment, clearly. So if you're a software as a service company, you might have started with 5 employees. You could 1,000x yourself and you're still only at 30 employees, right? And so a company like that is holding data, is making a ton of money. It might have an investor from a private equity sort of community involved in it. And if it is touching, in 2020, it was touching 1,000 people. And in 2024, it's touching 5 million. They may not have made the infrastructure investment to support proper cybersecurity, however you want to define it, or to respond to a cybersecurity incident. And so that's an area where there's a lot of, particularly in Florida, you know, it's a lot, an area of a lot of growth here, particularly after, you know, the tech investment in Miami, the tech investment in the Orlando area, saw a lot of growth stage companies that are in the software business that are blowing up. And a company like that, that is trying to stay lean because, you know, every other software license they sell is pure profit to them, you know, making a sort of concurrent investment in their cybersecurity controls is really important.
Right. So, Jack, we talked a lot about consumer protections. I'm curious if there are any laws in Florida that protect organizations from liability that result from a cyber attack. I'm guessing the answer is no.
Well, but I think the absence of a law telling a private company what it has to do itself is good, right? Okay. So I think not having a law that says you must do this is somewhat helpful in Florida, because as soon as a state government starts telling a business what it has to do for cyber, if it doesn't do that thing, it can become a source of legal risk for it. And so the absence of a comprehensive privacy statute does help businesses in Florida experiment, I guess. One good way to say it would be experiment with how it wants to do consumer disclosures. The larger companies that are in Florida, though, that have a presence in New York or California or Texas, other states that have different privacy regimes, are already complying with those states' regimes. So they're okay. But yeah, there's not a clear, what we might call a safe harbor in the law in Florida right now. So that's been another, when there have been attempts at comprehensive privacy or cybersecurity legislation in Florida, sometimes there have been sort of the two steps. So if step one is we're going to give you a private cause of action for consumers to sue companies, but we're also going to give a safe harbor to those companies that if they comply with reasonable identified cybersecurity standards and get a certification from a third party, for example, then they could not be liable in a lawsuit. Now, that said, how do you prove that, right? Can I just take my certification on the day the lawsuit's filed and hand it over? California has experimented with this, and it essentially, if a consumer identifies an alleged breach of the privacy statute, they give notice to the company, and the company has 30 days to put up or shut up in terms of showing their own compliance. I've never seen a plaintiff's attorney back down upon that put up or shut up 30-day waiting period. So I would be interested in seeing kind of what we would come up with in Florida that could help that. But that's another bullet point that would be on the legislation checklist if Florida were thinking about doing something more. And we've seen it in some of the bills that have played around over the last few years. If they're going to offer private cause of action, there's got to be some kind of safe harbor. And then there are ways you can make that more or less business friendly.
Jack, didn't the state do something similar for local governments recently? I know they have sovereign immunity up to a certain amount, but didn't they say that if you try to come, you can prove you can comply with this, this provides you safe haven?
Yeah. So in the last 3 years, Florida has passed the State Cybersecurity Act, and then I think it's the Local Government Cybersecurity Act is the other one. And they're pretty cool and pretty innovative set of statutes. And I think some of it's really good. And I think some of it's really bad. But there are concepts of put up or shut up there. But I think most municipalities are relying on sovereign immunity as its first line defense, right? And the immunity caps at 200 or 300, depending on the incident. And also, what kind of money are you going to get if you're a plaintiff's attorney and you're looking for millions and millions of dollars from a small city in Florida, right? I mean, they just also rely on being what we call judgment-proof plaintiffs in a lot of cases. The overall critique, to the extent there is one for those laws, is that they're putting on some municipalities and state entities pretty onerous obligations of compliance without fully funding the opportunity to get there, right? It's one thing to say everybody needs to become NIST compliant or ISO compliant. Great, that'd be awesome. We have 40 employees. How should we do that, right? You know what I mean? You're just like, great, I'd love to be NIST compliant. I looked it up on the internet. Me and my team of 39 here, you know, in this small port city in Florida, what are we supposed to do? And they did try to address that. I mean, there were requirements in terms of when it would be phased in based on the size of the municipality, at least for the Local Government Act. I think they tried. But at the same time, I think the what's going to be interesting when everything comes online in 2025 for the Local Government Cybersecurity Act is the state going to do anything to try to enforce it? I know that, I've talked to a number of municipalities who are trying really, really hard. There's no way they're going to get there. There's just no way.
Right.
And this is outside of a client context, right? Just talking with them in the community. I think they're looking for solutions. Cyber Florida has been really good about getting it out there. Florida Digital Services. So, I mean, there are entities that you can look to assist if you're a municipality and you're worried about this. Get on it, right? They got to get on it.
I ask you a bit of a leading question so I could give our own little shameless plug there. For any of our local government friends that are listening, we can help you with some of those compliance questions. We've got dollars the state has given us for some of the trainings, and we're working on further resources to help get you NIST compliant. So please reach out to us. You know, we always leave the email addresses at the end of each episode. We'd love to be a resource to you as you struggle with that.
Yeah. And NIST compliance is not, it's not hyper technical, right? So I think a lot of folks who saw that provision thought it was, but when they actually did look at it, it wasn't. I mean, it's challenging. It requires a risk management insight, but you don't need to be technically inclined to at least to understand it. So you could have a risk person in the municipality working with an IT or information security person, and they could get decently far, at least with a self-assessment.
Yeah, it's. I think you hit the nail on the head earlier. It's a question of manpower, I think, most of the time, even more than expertise. I can say this because I'm proudly from one of Florida's rural counties, but you're not joking. The county manager could be also be the county attorney and the PTA president and the nighttime janitor all in one. Yeah. They have to do a lot with a little, so I can understand the intimidation.
Yeah. And let's be fair, like that person is awesome, right? Like that person you're describing is like a hero. And it does frustrate me as someone who does want to get this right, when you see another burden being put on the person who is, you know, who wakes up early, makes the coffee, and then mops up at night, right? And does everything in between, that person now has to deal with this. What I am hoping to see is pooling of resources together where localities decide to work together and get on the similar network. Or, you know, do you need to offer a digital service as a solution for paying things? Why not just go back to accepting payments in person or payments via mail, right? I mean, there are like, does a 5,000 person municipality need an app, right? Does it need an app, right? Why does it have an app, right? Just don't have an app, right? So some of this is some of the prevention steps. You know, there's a fair amount of time where like I respond to a breach, not with a municipality, but like with a company. And it's sort of like, why are you holding this data? Like what, is anyone using this? And the answer is no. Like you don't need 10 years worth of email active in an Outlook email inbox. You don't need it, right? No one is looking at that. Get it off of there, put it somewhere else, and have a 6-month rolling inbox archive, right? Like some of the questions that do we need to comply? Like, no. Just get rid of it. Don't hold all this stuff. And why are you accepting credit card payments for taxes, right? Just don't accept credit card payments for taxes, right? Just write a check, get a wire, get a money order, right? Like don't get involved in PCI DSS. Like just don't get involved in that world, right? It's sometimes someone will come and say to me, can you keep something secret for me? And I say, no, I don't want to hold it. I don't want to hold your secret. I don't even know what it is. Don't. So I think there are some municipalities, like there are some companies that think they can hoover up all this data and it's going to somehow help them. So don't take in data unless you have a plan to monetize it or have a plan to be helpful with it. If you're a municipality, like, are you going to help people with this data? If not, you don't need them. You don't need, you know, 30 years worth of bail records, right? If you're in the sheriff's office, like you don't need them, like just package it up, send it somewhere, right? Take it off your connected servers and look at it if you really need to it. But any of that, I mean, That's one way you can, the policy of least privilege can also be extended to simply shredding things from time to time.
Right, right.
Jordan, he sounds like my wife, Erica, walking through our garage. Why do you still have that? Yeah.
But it's true, right? I don't want to, you know, it's like, Jay Leno has like 200 cars. You're like, I don't want 200 cars, right? Then I'd have to change the oil on 200 cars, right? I want to have responsibilities that I can easily manage. And I think sometimes, certainly municipalities are always thinking, like, you know, a good example is AI, right? Like, oh, we got to use AI. I got to use AI. Do you? Do you need AI, right? Are you having so many phone calls that we have to automate this phone call process, right? And so there's a lot of times it's just because we can doesn't mean we should. Like the idea of election security is just dipping a finger in ink the day you vote, you know? Like this idea, like, why are we doing all this crazy stuff? Like, just make it simple. There's simpler solutions to a lot of these problems.
Yeah, for sure. Jack, do you have any specific policy recommendations that you might offer to our state legislature that might help organizations better protect themselves in the current cyber threat landscape?
Seeing this is a policy podcast, that would be a good question.
I'll tell you some things that have come up, right? Not necessarily where I think it should go. Because I mean, I think where I think it should go is, I think it should be a federal standard, period, right? It should be the federal government, to the extent they want to do this, should take an industry agnostic approach to some basic outlines and displace what a lot of the states are doing, right? And that's me being an experienced professional in this space rather than advocating any client position. But there are some things that Florida has done that have been innovative, and there are some things Florida has done that are not fantastic, right? So I think with the State Cybersecurity Act, right, there was an accompanying bill that became a law, which was a really, really, really big deal that we don't talk about enough, which is Florida has banned state agencies and municipalities from paying ransoms, right? It's like a one-line statute, sits there on its own. It just says you can't pay ransoms. I think maybe North Carolina followed suit shortly thereafter, but there was a lot of kind of conversation about whether this was a good idea or a bad idea. Are we in fact reducing demand so that maybe some Florida municipalities won't be targeted because they simply can't pay, right? Or is this just silly? Are we just tying the hands of municipalities who may be in a desperate situation would need to pay, right? But I think it's a very cool concept. I want access to some more information to see how it's going in Florida, because if it works, right, if overall Florida can show that it's decreasing the infrastructure attacks on our municipalities, we got to sell that then to other states, because that's awesome, right? I just don't know if it's been working or not, but it was really debated and Florida did it, right? So they had the strength of their convictions and went forward with it. So I think that's a thing that is cool. I want to see some data on it, because if it's good, it should spread. And then two, I have criticized, there's some language in the Local Government Cybersecurity Act that I've criticized before about the way they described the standard. So what Florida said is, quote, generally accepted best practices, close quote. Then it went on to talk about NIST and some of the other CIS controls, right? So in the law, you have two different things. You have best practices and you have standard practices. Standard practices is like the negligence standard. It's like, you know, what does a reasonable company or a reasonable person do, right? It might be when you ride your bike, you wear a helmet. Or it might be if I'm going to put a ladder up, I'm going to have two people, one person holding it, one person on the ladder. Best practices is really different, right? Best practices is more than what the average person does. Best practices is a bike helmet, elbow pads, knee pads, reflective visors, blinking lights, an insurance policy on myself. Right. So I didn't like that Florida was mixing best practices, which should never be a standard, versus industry standard practices, which is an okay standard. Right. And so I think that's another area where if they were ever going to do another polish of these laws, they could get cleaned up, because I don't think it's what they intended. And I think it sort of makes an odd standard and should not be borrowed if you're ever going to fool around with it from the state, for a private company perspective. It would be kind of a disaster if they did something like that. And then, so I think like that framework is something that's going to be, we're going to also want to watch and see if putting that in there. So I think the rest of the stuff that we've seen a ton of different bills that have come through, you know, I don't think states should act to create inconsistent laws given the patchwork that's out here. But if they were to do it, right, I'll give one sort of tip that I've seen from working in a number of different states on states' law is, if they're going to pass any kind of comprehensive privacy bill in Florida, there's two choices for what they call the exemptions. So some states have done entity-level exemptions if the entity is covered by other federal laws, which would include things like Gramm-Leach-Bliley for financial institutions or HIPAA for hospitals and doctor's offices. Meaning, if you're already complying with some part of your organization with those laws, this new state law for privacy isn't going to apply to you. Just keep doing what you're doing under the federal standard. We're going to get out of your way, okay? And then other states have had what they call data level exemptions, where one piece of data, when it's used for HIPAA purposes or used for Gramm-Leach-Bliley purposes, would not be covered by the state law. But if it's used for something like marketing, for example, it would be. And that's really confusing and hard, and it almost eats up the exception. So I think if Florida were to go for some form of comprehensive state privacy, I would advocate pretty hard that it'd be the right thing to do to have entity level exemptions if they're covered by state insurance regulator or a federal regime that's well established. So anyway, I have a million other ideas, but those are sort of my three sort of big talking points that I think are good. They already fixed one. So if we had this conversation 2 years ago, my main complaint in Florida was that the Public Records Act and the Sunshine Law did not allow for authentic conversations at the municipal level about cybersecurity. And they were revealing their cybersecurity plans to the public, or they were like shoehorning it into fire safety plans or security plans, like physical security, right? Which were not irrational, right? Those are perfectly reasonable things. But Florida largely cleaned that up, I think maybe 2 years ago. So now, you know, obviously consult with your own, this isn't legal advice, you know, municipalities should consult with their own lawyers, but there's a lot more protection to have authentic in the shade conversations about cybersecurity measures. And so you can have these conversations about complying with Florida law and what they, I believe now, is generally accepted best practices.
Now, Jack, back to the ransomware bill that you had talked about. If I remember correctly, I remember when that bill, passed, and I think I remember thinking that there wasn't an enforcement mechanism in that. And I don't know why my mind keeps going to enforcing. Can they enforce that? Do you know, is there an enforcement mechanism? Like, how do they enforce these, state entities to report a ransomware incident? Yeah. And do we need an enforcement mechanism? Should we leave that alone?
Yeah. So I'm not going to answer that last question, but should we?
Okay.
Because it's a good question. I'm not going to answer it, but I will tell you this. So there's the State Cybersecurity Act. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Local Government Cybersecurity Act, and they have in them reporting requirements for certain events. Like if there's a ransomware attack, I think it's 48 hours that you have to get it into the Florida Digital Center, whatever it's called. I don't know if they've even set up the hotline yet, but there's a hotline that's essentially the disaster recovery hotline that you're supposed to use to report that stuff. And so you do have a reporting requirement for ransom, right? So if you're a victim of a ransomware attack, you got to tell the state so that they can coordinate, potentially help you, but there is like a disclosure requirement, but the standalone, you can't pay ransom, does not within the statute say how it's going to be enforced. It just doesn't say, right? You could potentially, you could put it together working all those parts of the title kind of next to each other, but I'll leave that for litigants to sort out if they need to do so. But yeah, if you were to read the statute, I mean, it's elegant, but it is short. And it does not include an enforcement mechanism, at least in the title or in the that I can see with the naked eye.
Thank you for answering that. That last question, I threw that in there.
They talk about it, right? Like municipalities know, and insurers know, right? And brokers know that municipalities don't pay ransoms, full stop, right?
So, well, I just remember it being the very first thing I thought when I read that. I'm like, and then what? Like, what are you going to,
Yeah, I mean, if it's your water supply, and it's one Bitcoin, and you got a Bitcoin, or insurance company will pay for a Bitcoin, it's pretty hard to say I'm not going to pay this Bitcoin. You can imagine scenarios in which it seems irrational to have a law like this, but this is what we have the government for. Yeah,
right. I think I remember a cyber attack years ago in Georgia that took out the 911. Lines or something like that. And it's like, what do you do at that point? You're first responders are unreachable, you know? And so it does kind of, like you said, place them in a tough position. Yep. But I think to your point also, I'm curious to see how it's working.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think the good news though about the sort of report and collect is that, I mean, I don't know if there was a design behind it. It probably wasn't thought of this way, but at some point, right, if municipalities are obeying the 48-hour reporting requirement for ransomware, like we'll have a pretty good block of evidence as to how many ransomware attacks there have been at least identified within the state of Florida. And if we can compare that to another state, you know, on a per capita basis, maybe we can see whether the ban on paying ransom has in fact decreased it. I mean, anecdotally, I would report no. right? But that's just my perch, which is a limited one.
I think that I could be totally wrong, but I think that there's data that shows that organizations who do pay ransoms are typically hit again, like more often or again, something like that, like because hackers know that they will pay. So I wonder, I mean, maybe it is a deterrent. You know, they know they're not allowed to pay, like you said. And I think that could be the purpose of the bill. And I think a lot of it also was too, is we don't negotiate with terrorists, whatever, that type of thing. We're not going to pay that. We're not going to play. But anyways.
No, I totally get why it happens. If it's effective, it would be cool to see it being adopted by other states, at least for municipalities and state agencies. So I think if the story is a good one we're telling from Florida, it should travel.
Sure.
Right. And you make a really good point, Jordan, and one I actually hadn't thought about, right? Which is exactly that, which is the two bite at the apple ransomware, mm-hmm. which is 1,000% true. Right. If you pay a ransom, you got to be prepared for them to come back. And you, mm-hmm. you can't pay the ransom. Like if you pay the ransom without knowing how they got in, just get right back in. Right. So you're just thinking, wow, what are we doing here? Right. That doesn't mean that in really, really, really hard circumstances, you don't pay the ransom though, because sometimes companies do. Right. Mm-hmm. But again, sure. 10 years ago, companies would pay ransoms. 5 years ago, some would. And now it's a lot less likely they're paying the ransom. And if they do, companies tend to pay ransoms not to unlock the data, but they pay ransoms to prevent data from being disclosed on the dark web to the public. Sure. It's that extortionate piece that is motivating a lot of decision makers.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been an awesome conversation, Jack. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, it was great to be on the show, James and Jordan. Thanks, guys, so much. And look forward to seeing you all again soon at the next Cyber Florida event.
Perfect. Yep. Jordan beat me to it. I really appreciate you, man. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break, guys, and we'll be right back with so Jordan can share some updates from Cyber Florida and the Shameless Plug.
Welcome to Cyber Florida's Shameless Plug with Jordan.
State and local government entities can find resources related to compliance with the cybersecurity laws discussed in today's episode on the Cyber Florida website, cyberflorida.org, as well as on the Florida Digital Services website. Florida Digital Services has published a local government resource packet that outlines cybersecurity training and incident response guidelines and best practices, which was designed to support local governments in complying with the required cybersecurity standards. In the new year, be on the lookout for a policy brief from Cyber Florida concerning cybersecurity regulatory harmonization. In the meantime, check out cyberflorida.org, where you can find Cyber Florida's response to the Office of the National Cyber Director's request for information on the topic. I'm Jordan. That's my plug.
All opinions expressed by the Chat Cyber Podcast participants are their own and do not exclusively represent the views and opinions of Cyber Florida.